This week on Making Contact.
The sufferings of the land, it's all over the world. And if we don't combine ourselves, come together and fight this injustice, then we are going to suffer forever.
Concentrated ownership, overdevelopment, and skyrocketing values all are making land less and less accessible. These recent trends in agriculture have meant big changes, not just to small farmers in the U.S. In the developing world, farming is a constant struggle to survive. On this edition, we'll take a look at the challenges rural people face and the growing international movement to gain land rights. I'm Pauline Bartolone, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Millions of landless rural peasants live in miserable conditions around the world. In developing countries, many are stuck in a colonial ownership model, where a small elite hold the majority of the country's land. Landless workers are forced to sow someone else's property, as migrants are sharecroppers, with inadequate access to social services and no opportunities to escape poverty. The concentration of land in the hands of a few has historically been a problem in Africa. In Egypt, land reforms for the past 50 years have led to modest redistribution. But Karim Saber of the Land Center for Human Rights, an advocacy organization for farmers in Egypt, says his country is a long way from having a just agricultural model. During a speech at the 2005 World Social Forum, he described how recent economic policies have forced many farmers off their land.
Until the 80s, farmers used to plant the land and they didn't have many problems with the government or with the large landowners. But after the implementation of the World Bank strategies or plans for Egypt and the large corporations, more than 1 million Egyptian farmers have been evicted out of their lands. And the cost of rent of land increased by more than 13 times. And the struggle of the farmers or peasants of Egypt against the policies of the World Bank and the big corporations helped by the government is that they paid more than 100 farmers killed or martyrs in the course of the struggle.
لأن قوات البوليس في مصر كانت بتحبس الفلاحين اللي بيرفضوا الخروج من الأرض وكانت بيتم اعتقالهم.
They were forced out of their lands, and those who refused or objected were put away, of course, in prison and incarcerated.
السياسات الإصلاح أو ما سمي بسياسات في مصر بنسميها سياسات الإفقار للفلاحين.
Instead of land reform and agrarian reform, it's really impoverishment reform.
أدت إلى رفع القيمة الإيجارية إلى 13 ضعف القيمة الإيجارية.
Cost of land and cost of resources to work on the land have increased many fold.
أدت لنقص في الاكتفاء الذاتي من الغذاء بالنسبة للمصريين.
There is less self-sufficiency in agrarian produce for Egypt.
وفقد الفلاحين المصريين حوالي 1.5 million.
And the peasants have lost more than 1.5 million fadans or acres of agricultural land for building purposes.
وحتى الآن يعني من حوالي شهر ما زالت هذه السياسات.
And these policies are encouraged by the international corporations that supposedly aid the Egyptian government.
قرية في مصر تسمى قرية سرندو من في أول العام.
In one case in a village of Sirindo recently, the farmers refused to be evicted from their land, refused to leave. So the army interfered and the government sent the armed forces to force the peasants out, and they put away many of them in prison and actually kicked them out of their land by force.
ورغم المبررات الكتير اللي بتقولها الحكومة المصرية ومن وراها المؤسسات الدولية.
And in spite of the claims of the international institutions and the Egyptian government, actually statistics and research has shown that the traditional peasants in Egypt produce more per plot of land than the big corporations. There are dozens of organizations defending the rights of peasants and farmers in Egypt and in their struggle to gain their rights. But such efforts need cooperation and coordination of all the similar forces in the world struggling for a better world and a different world.
شكرا على حسن استماعكم.
Thank you for your good listening.
That was Karam Saber of Egypt's Land Center for Human Rights. Agrarian reform programs sponsored by the World Bank have been a failure, according to international peasant movements. In Brazil, for example, the bank financed market-based reforms that introduced apply-by-mail and credit lending programs depended on the voluntary sale of property by large landowners. Both initiatives flopped. Poorly designed agrarian programs have left out the landless people themselves, says Sergio Saud of Brazil's Pastoral Lands Commission, a faith-based agrarian reform organization. At the 2005 World Social Forum, he said the problem lies at the fuzzy line between government and financial institutions.
So a question that I have is, why is such a powerful institution like the World Bank suddenly concerned with a topic like agrarian reform?
Há várias razões.
There are several reasons.
Mas a retórica, ou seja, aquilo que eles nos dizem.
Now, one point important point has to do with the rhetorical aspects. What are they saying to who?
É que é para combater a pobreza.
It's clear that to combat poverty in developing countries, access to land is a fundamental issue, and they can't deny that.
Essa é a retórica. A prática, na verdade, é.
Now, the bank says that it's promoting policies to improve access to land, but what this rhetoric really does is it serves like a disguise for policies which are designed to promote markets in buying and selling land.
Bom, a pergunta é, o que fazer diante dessas políticas?
What can we do when we're faced with these market policies?
Eu pessoalmente acreditava, depois de 5 anos de governo FHC, em que os movimentos sociais.
So I believe that after 5 years of struggle by social movements against these policies, including in the previous government.
O governo Lula iria.
I mean, I believe then that after so many years of struggle in the Fernando Henrique government, that when the Lula government came in, it was going to stop these World Bank land market policies.
Ao contrário, o governo FHC.
But exactly the opposite happened. One of the first things that the Lula government did was to approve a big package of financing for 50,000 families through the land bank model, which is the World Bank model.
Mas o governo Lula decidiu ampliar esse.
And the Lula government decided to expand this financing, adding additional resources to use this model to supposedly address the needs of 130,000 families over 3 years.
O que nós tivemos como experiência de resistência às políticas do Banco Mundial.
We have a lot of experience resisting policies of the World Bank.
Foram em diferentes direções e, diria assim, espaços.
We did different kinds of resistance using different techniques and in different spaces.
Uma opção foi, inclusive.
So, for example, at one point, we, after various discussions, we decided to try to challenge these policies from inside the World Bank through the World Bank's inspection panel.
Resumidamente, tentamos utilizar.
I mean, we were basing this on the World Bank's own stated supposed principles that all of their projects should reduce poverty, should combat corruption, should promote the autonomy of countries that are receiving funding.
E aí solicitamos painéis de inspeção e isso.
So it is true that when we filed the complaint with the inspection panel, there was a slight reduction in the intensity of these programs in Brazil.
Em outros termos, são.
So what we can conclude from those kind of inside mechanisms is they do have some effect, but very limited.
Em outras palavras, o que tem sido mais efetivo é.
So in other words, what we've found to be most effective, both in terms of political struggle as well as in terms of direct action.
E aqui, no caso dos brasileiros, estou chovendo no molhado.
So our most effective means to challenge the methods and discourse of the World Bank has been to directly, through social struggle, seize land.
Para concluir, mesmo que essa tenha sido o nosso...
And we found that while the land occupation is the most important part of our struggle, we also have to confront the World Bank in what we might call the symbolic arena of struggle.
That was Sergio Saur of Brazil's Pastoral Lands Commission. We'll have more about agrarian reform in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast online at radioproject.org. Whether it's water, forests, loan agencies, or even government research, everything an agricultural worker depends on is becoming increasingly privatized. Because of the changes, farmers are under more pressure than ever to pay for social services. Peter Rosset is a researcher at the Institute for Change in the Mexican Countryside, a nonprofit farmer advocacy organization based in Oaxaca, Mexico. He's also former co-director of Food First, based in Oakland, California. We spoke with Rosset about the landless movements opposing privatization and the colonial ownership model in the developing world. He says rural farmers are now being pushed to a breaking point.
The land issue has a lot of dimensions that vary from different parts of the world, but definitely there is a major land issue or land question in all continents. So we can take a quick look in Latin America. Is the continent with the most inequitable distribution of land, where you have a small minority owning most of the land and then a large majority that's landless. And so the struggle for land reform in Latin America is to expropriate the large estates, which mostly were put together by stealing, not buying land from poor people. In Asia, there are some countries which have Latin American-style land distributions, like the Philippines, Indonesia, so the struggle there is similar to Latin America. Africa has some countries that are like Latin America, mostly the colony countries like South Africa, Zimbabwe, Kenya, and then other countries where there's still a lot of traditional communal land management systems, but they're being encroached upon by large export plantations of transnational corporations. And so... In addition to the colonial elite landowning structure, which is still there, then there's also the squeezing of the whole production chain by the transnational corporations who monopolize buying and exporting agricultural products and therefore are able to impose lower and lower and lower prices on farmers or salaries on farm workers. And so that's one of the intensification factors, along with free trade policies, that have taken the already horrible, inequitable land distribution system, which already generated poverty and then squeezed people even more, basically to the breaking point where movements start growing very fast.
Rosset says market-led reform swept the developing world during the 1990s, but have not managed to solve the problems caused by the concentration of land ownership. He says these reforms, sponsored by institutions like the World Bank, do not give farmers the support they need to obtain their own land.
We've done studies in Guatemala, in Indonesia, in Philippines, in Brazil, and South Africa, in Colombia, and in no cases do these symbolic programs provide enough credit for more than 1% of the landless population to actually acquire land. So by creating land markets, they're not helping poor people. They're helping rich people and corporations that want to accumulate more land. For example, in Thailand, communities that had secure access to what was theoretically public land, but that they farmed communally for more than 1,000 years, were told, now you're going to get your own individual titles. Isn't that great? You'll become landowners. Within 3 years after the communities got individual titles, which the bank told them would give them greater security of land tenure, they've been forced to sell their land because it was right before the Asian financial crisis. Crop prices crashed, and they couldn't survive farming, and land that they had secure access to for 1,000 years. Communally, they lost in 3 years under this individual land titling, which is it's just another way of saying privatize the land, and then with economic distress conditions, people lose it from distress sales, or they get too indebted to the bank, they can't pay off the credit. Now that it's a private title, they've mortgaged it to get credit, the bank takes it away, then the bank auctions it, and then rich people get it.
Many countries have agrarian reform laws written into their constitutions, but as Rosset explains, the government's proverbial hands are tied to international institutions that hinder the reform process. He says because of government inaction, rural movements such as Brazil's MST, or Landless Workers Movement, have resorted to occupying privately owned land. By directly seizing plots and living on them until they're expropriated by the government, the movement says it is carrying out the redistribution process as laid out in Brazil's constitution.
And with this strategy, they've been able in 20 years to settle about 300,000 formerly landless families. We're talking about more than 1 million people on something like 20 million hectares of land. I mean, it's absolutely staggering, the proportion of what they've been able to do. It's like a whole small country that they've created inside the large country of Brazil, in which people who are the poorest of the poor, the most excluded from Brazilian society, people living in the favela slums, landless migratory farm workers in rural areas, homeless people, people with substance abuse problems, the most excluded, have organized themselves, cleaned up their lives, and become productive farming communities.
In the past couple of decades, social movements seeking agrarian reform have spread throughout the world. Rosset says these movements aren't just fighting the current economic model, but are standing for what they call food sovereignty.
Food sovereignty is a concept that was coined by the international peasant movement Via Campesina, and it's a holistic alternative model to the dominant model of agricultural development. The dominant model is agro-export, it's large production units, it's mechanization, it's free trade, it's GMOs, it's agrochemicals, it's excluding people and biodiversity from rural areas. There are many different aspects of the dominant model that are bad. And you can't just resolve all those problems, say, with just land reform or with just ecological farming practices. Because it's many aspects of the model at this point, what the social movements are saying is we need a different model. And the different model is food sovereignty. It means rather than putting the priority on agro-export, priority should be put on the national economy, the local economy, on producing food for people in countries where they're hungry people instead of exporting all of the agricultural production and leaving people hungry. It means farmers should have the right to produce. That means you can't allow Cargill or Archer Daniels Midland to take their own local markets away from them with cheap subsidized produce flooding in. So it means no to free trade.
The problems associated with land concentration aren't confined to the developing world. Rosset says farmers in the U.S. and Europe are also struggling to remain competitive with agribusiness and face obstacles associated with rising land values.
I think the great unaddressed problem right now is land in developed countries in the north. You can't get access to land in the United States to become a farmer. If you're a young family or individual who wants to farm, you just take one look at land prices that have been driven up by speculation, and you can basically forget it. Dominant economic model in the U.S. is driving about 160,000 farmers a year into bankruptcy and off the land. In the European Economic Community, 200,000 farmers a year being driven off the land. Taxpayers in both Europe and the U.S. pay massive subsidies to agriculture, but it only goes to large corporate farms. 50%, the 50% that are family farmers get nothing. About 10% of the farmers get 70% of the subsidies in both the U.S. and the EU. And something has got to change. If we don't have some kind of land reform, agrarian reform that takes into account the entire inequitable system of access to land, low prices to farmers, unfair subsidies that only go to the rich, we're not going to have any food and agriculture production left.
That was Peter Rosset of the Institute for Change in the Mexican Countryside and former co-director of Food First. During the Great Depression, Ben and Joe Francia of Sunnyvale, California, learned to farm in what was then known as the Valley of Heart's Delight. Now over 80 years of age, the brothers are the last remaining farmers in Silicon Valley. Surrounded by highway and the high-tech industry, they have resisted selling their plot of land in return for a comfortable retirement. In this excerpt of a short video documentary called Lawrence Station Road, produced by Adam Burgess, the Francia brothers explain why they would never give up their way of life.
We had to get up early in the morning. We had to wash turnips and green onions. We started pedaling with bicycles to little stores. Come home with 50 cents or a dollar, you know. Mom, she put it in a little jar in the cupboard, and she says, well, this is what we're going to use for buying so many sacks of flour and whatever we need for the winter time. But we were poor. I mean, we were poor.
I am a farmer from way, way back. Way back where? We've been farming since 1926 with my dad. At that time was depression days. You know, it was hard days. Land was cheap. People came around begging for if we could buy their land. You know, we're getting bigger and older, so we want to expand, right? So we bought this parcel of 20 acres down in Santa Clara. At that time, when we bought that 65 years ago, it was just a little, it was a little better than $1,000 an acre. But right now, you can't even touch the dust for $1,000 an acre.
It was brothers. We worked all our lives together. And Mom and Dad says when they were gone, they would wish that we would continue working together, which we are today. Ben at 81, and I'm 79, and we're still together.
We get along good. When my father was farming, we worked as three, as one. Three, but one. My father did all the bossing, told us what to do, and we did as he said. My father passed away. I'm the oldest, and I'm next down the list. I give orders. They do what I say. I mean, we once in a while get in a little row, you know, but not boxing matches. Do you ever see these guys go in the bar? They get a shot of whiskey. What do? They feel like fighting the world, right? Because they're strong, because it's not them, but it's the booze that they drank. It's in their system. It makes them do a lot of crazy things. So commercial fertilizer is the same way. You give it a shot of commercial fertilizer, boosts the plant, but it's not good for the following year because the ground needs minerals. It needs fertilizing. Anything artificial, we don't believe in that.
My dad was a firm believer in, you know, horse manure, cow manure, or whatever. And we used to use a lot of it until we got here. And we used to put yards and yards of loads of horse manure, cow manure, which we used to haul from Fremont. And we used to put it out here, and then it got to the point where people used to get a whiff of it and the flies, and that kind of put the stop to it.
I was married for 42 years. My wife passed away 20 years ago. If I stay home one day, I got, just look at four walls. You know how it is when you're by yourself. You got nobody to talk to. I mean, I'd come with my brother. We talk, you know. And you come out here, you see a neighbor, you start talking to him. You see a customer that's been coming in here for years, you talk to him. And that's the way your day goes by.
This area was just all farmland. It was just all completely dairies and a lot of orchards. In fact, when orchards were in bloom, you can smell the bloom and blossoms, you know.
I used to farm 700 acres one time. Where is it at now? Now it's all homes and electronic buildings. The expressway was called Lawrence Station Road, and it was only a two-laner. And you used to see a car, maybe one or two cars, every in an hour. It's a different world altogether. I wish I was living in that world. I got a daughter, and she's married. She's got two boys, and they're all going to college. They don't even, you can't even talk to them about farming. They don't like it. But my daughter, my oldest daughter, she's got a big farm down in Chowchilla, down south. She's got an almond grove down there. Yeah.
What else there is to do when you get at our age? All we've been doing is farming. And that's, we love what we're doing. And that's why we continue. You just figure out, you've done a day's work and you wait for the next day and you go back at the same old thing and you're happy. When you work with dirt, it's the greatest thing a human being could do if you're a farmer.
Yeah, but I mean, I follow the pattern of the younger people. I do the same thing. They live it up, I try to live it up too. I was kind of, you know, wild in my younger days, you know. But I did a lot of work, though. They tell us we're crazy to do what we're doing, because just the interest alone, we can live like kings, but no, we love what we're doing. We're farmers. From our heart, not farmers that just do it today and forget about it tomorrow.
That was an excerpt from Lawrence Station Road, a video documentary by Adam Burgess. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Emily Polk for production assistance. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production, funded primarily by generous gifts from people in the community. We are committed to providing a unique forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have ideas for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a CD copy of program number 0506, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Tina Rubio, senior producer, Justin Beck, producer, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, outreach coordinator, Tom Evans, development associate, Emily Polk, production fellow. And I'm your host, Pauline Bartoloni. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
The debate over the peaking of oil on the planet has begun. And for the scientists involved, it is not so much a question of if or how, but when.
You think Cheney was kidding when he said a war that won't end in our lifetimes? Do you think Cheney was kidding when he said this is going to be the biggest conflict that we've ever seen?
These are voices from the Canadian film The End of Suburbia, Oil Depletion, and the Collapse of the American Dream. You are about to hear part one of an hour-long program on peak oil, recorded at the International Inquiry into 911 in San Francisco in March of 2004. The first speaker is Richard Heinberg. He's on the core faculty of New College of California and the author of The Party is Over, War, Oil, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. Oil is indispensable to our way of life, and oil is the one essential source of U.S. imperial power. What if the supply of oil was running out now, or in the very near future? How would that change our lives? And would the U.S. empire collapse if we ran out of oil? And what does oil have to do with the events of 9/11 and the two recent wars by the U.S. on Afghanistan and Iraq? Here is Richard Heinberg.
Oil is essential for our modern way of life, and it has been a remarkable party that we have all been enjoying for our lifetimes and really for the last century or so. I still occasionally meet people who can remember when they saw the first automobile in their town. And it's such a pleasure speaking with someone of that age and getting the sense of what it must have been like to see the beginning of this modern industrial era and to be able to remember something before it. Most of us, however, have known nothing else. This is what we expect. This is normal reality to us. But normal reality is changing. It seems to me that we are, in fact, living in an oil empire. And like all of the great empires of the past, this empire is in the beginning stages of again, what all empires tend to do. It's in the beginning stages of collapse because of resource depletion. We can trace back civilizations for thousands of years, and most of them have declined for essentially the same reason. Only the nature of the resource is different. In most cases, it's topsoil or fresh water. In this case, it's oil and water and topsoil. I like to use 1950 as a reference point because it was the year I was born. Back in 1950, the U.S. was the world's foremost oil-producing nation, the world's foremost oil-exporting nation. When I talk to my students about this, most of them are in their 20s, and they tend to assume that the U.S. has always been importing oil. No, oil is what made the U.S. rich and powerful. We were the Saudi Arabia of the early 20th century. We were exporting oil. Seven out of every eight barrels of oil used in World Wars I and World War II by the Allies to win those wars came from American oil wells. We were also the world's largest exporter of machine tools, manufactured goods, world's foremost creditor nation. We were loaning money to the rest of the world, and we were self-sufficient in nearly all resources. How things have changed. Now we're the world's foremost oil importing nation by far, the world's foremost debtor nation, again, by far, world's foremost importer of manufactured goods and non-petroleum resources. And, of course, our manufacturing jobs are fleeing to other countries. Now, is this just the result of mismanagement? Well, of course, there's been plenty of that. But I would suggest that it all has to do with the depletion of the resource that made all of that possible in the first place. It all started in the 1860s, when the first oil wells were discovered in Pennsylvania, and very quickly smart young fellow by the name of John D. Rockefeller hit upon the idea of cornering the market, and he became the richest individual in the world, and also his company, Standard Oil, became the world's first multinational corporation. And at first, the problem was figuring out what to do with this stuff because it was so cheap. The reason oil was drilled for in the first place was that we were running out of another resource. See, resource depletion tends to shake people out of their habits. We were running out of the resource of whale oil, which was being used for home illumination. So the idea was hit upon of using rock oil, which is the literal translation of petroleum, in its place, hence the petroleum industry. And for the first several decades, virtually all produced oil was refined into kerosene for home lighting. But there was so much of the stuff that they had to find other uses for it. So for machinery, lubrication, for running ships and heating homes, and eventually for the internal combustion engine. This graph is very important because it shows us the quantity of energy supplied by non-renewable fuels such as oil, gas, coal, nuclear electricity, and the amount of energy supplied by renewable sources such as wood, wind, hydroelectricity, and so on. And you'll see all of the growth since 1850 has been in non-renewable energy in the U.S. economy. Interestingly, there's not that much more renewable energy in the U.S. economy now than there was in 1850, only about twice as much today as 150 years ago. The reason for that, of course, is that nature can only provide so much on an ongoing basis, whereas fossil fuels are like winning the lottery or getting an inheritance from a rich uncle. You can go through it very quickly, but if you have to live on yearly income, then you have to restrain your spending a little bit. Each of us has become accustomed to a way of life that is extraordinary by any historical standards. If the services performed for us by fossil fuels had to be done by human muscle power, as was done only a few decades ago, each of us would have to have about 300 slaves to supply the same horsepower. And I don't know about you, I can kind of get off on the idea of having one or two energy slaves to pick up my dirty socks and so on, but to have 300 and think of that as normal, it's extraordinary. Now, this graph really shows the 20th century in a way that most of us are not accustomed to thinking about it, but it reveals a lot. The red vertical bars are oil discovery, and of course the black line is oil production in the lower 48 U.S. Oil discovery peaked in the 1930s with East Texas, and oil production peaked, as we saw in the film, in 1970. Now, as a result of the U.S. oil production peak in 1970, literally everything changed. U.S. being self-sufficient in oil now was becoming more and more dependent on resources from elsewhere. The Carter Doctrine in 1979. Of course, there was a global economic slump that resulted. The CIA woke up to peak oil. This intelligence memorandum from 1977, recently declassified, says the Soviet oil industry is in trouble. Soviet oil production will soon peak, probably as early as next year and certainly not later than the early 1980s. Actually, the Soviet oil production peak was in 1987. There's some evidence to suggest that this CIA memo resulted in the policies of the Reagan administration attempting to bankrupt the Soviet Union by lowering global oil prices through an agreement with Saudi Arabia to drive down prices during the 1980s, and then to start a proxy war in Afghanistan that would cause the Soviets to produce oil at the maximum possible rate in order to earn revenues from oil sales so that they could pay for the arms race and also for the Afghanistan war. It worked. 2 years after the Soviet oil production peak, the Soviet economy went belly up. Well, we're seeing the same phenomenon in country after country. Of the 44 principal oil-producing countries in the world, 24 are already past peak. So we're not talking about prognostication, really. We're not talking about crystal ball gazing. We're looking at history as it's happening. Every year it's possible to record another country, UK, Norway, Denmark, Oman, going over that peak and finding itself unable to produce as much oil as it did in the past. Global oil discovery peaked in the 1960s. This particular slide is from the PowerPoint presentation of the executive vice president of ExxonMobil, Henry Longwell. Thank you very much, Henry. Didn't get it from him personally, but from his website. Thank you so much. And it shows very clearly discovered oil volumes peaking in the 1960s. Now, at the very end there to the right, there's a little uptick, a little note of optimism. But look at that more closely, add more recent data. Fresh oil finds in 2001, 2002, very disappointing, resuming that downward trend. And 2003, Ken White, senior editor of the IHS report Discoveries and Highlights, he says 2003 didn't produce large unpredicted finds, and Chris Skrobosky, editor of Petroleum Review, described the year's exploration results as little short of horrifying in a recent editorial, noting that we would probably have to go back to the early 1920s to find a year when fewer large oil discoveries were made. Back in the 1960s, we were discovering much more oil every year than was being extracted from the ground, and that trend is gradually reduced so that now we're burning about 3 barrels of oil to 4 barrels of oil for every one that's discovered every year today. Oil Depletion Analysis Center in London and the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, also in Britain, keep very close track of current reserve and production figures. This is the ASPO 2004 scenario. The 2003 scenario showed a global peak around 2010 for all petroleum liquids. The 2004 scenario has that advance to 2007. The industry has been reluctant to comment on this, but if one reads between the lines, it's clear that at least some people in the industry know what's going on. John Thompson, president of ExxonMobil Exploration, says, "We estimate that world and gas production from existing fields is declining at an average rate of 4 to 6% a year to meet projected demand in 2015. The industry will have to add 100 million oil equivalent barrels a day of new production. That's equal to about 80% of today's production level. In other words, by 2015, we will need to find, develop, and produce a volume of new oil and gas that's equal to 8 out of every 10 barrels being produced today. In addition, the cost associated with providing this additional oil and gas is expected to be considerably more than what industry is now spending." Translation, it's not going to happen. Also, academic geologists, energy experts are reaching similar conclusions. Werner Zittel and Jürg Schindler, scientific advisors to the German parliament, their report, Future World Oil Supply, concluded basically the same things. Production peak of individual fields is already historical fact, and almost all large oil fields have already passed their production maximum and are in decline. And the pattern has been observed for more than 30 years. The aggregate decline of mature regions is getting steeper with every new member of the peak club. In order to keep overall production just flat, ever fewer regions have to increase their production. Therefore, it's very likely that the peak of world oil production will be reached before 2010 at the latest. Some recent headlines. Of course, Shell has had to downgrade its reported reserves not once but twice. Asian Wall Street Journal says OPEC producers are hitting limit on sweet crude production. OPEC takes backseat as oil prices run wild. Indonesia's crude oil output is expected to fall below 1 million barrels per day in 2004, down from 1.09 million barrels per day the previous year due to declining productivity. So, again, where's all the oil left? As we see, Europe, Asia Pacific, North America, former Soviet Union, Africa, South and Central America, and then the Middle East. Now, actually, the Middle East may not have quite as much as is shown there, because as we saw in the video, the reported reserves of OPEC countries of the Middle East are probably inflated, but nevertheless, there's a heck of a lot of hydrocarbons there. So what's the plan? Now, Dick Cheney, of course, is a former oil executive, and there's every reason to believe that he's familiar with the situation. He said in a speech in London, late 1999, by some estimates, quoting, there will be an average of 2% annual growth in global oil demand over the years ahead, along with, conservatively, a 3% natural decline in production from existing reserves. And he ended on an alarming note. That means by 2010, we will need on the order of an additional 50 million barrels a day. Now, the world currently produces and uses about 75 million barrels a day. So that means by 2010, two-thirds of what we're currently producing and using will have to be replaced by new production. And where is that going to come from? That's very unclear. Project for New American Century, in addition to outlining the need for American control of global oil reserves, also says the needed consensus in that regard will be difficult to achieve absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And, of course, that's exactly what happened, a new Pearl Harbor on September 11th, 2001. Now, the alternative that most of us, I think, would like to see is a very different approach. First of all, the people of America and the people of the world will have to be informed of what's happening and told that our current way of life is, in fact, unsustainable. And we will have to transition from fossil fuels, which, as we see in this graph from the U.S. Department of Energy, fossil fuels, which currently account for over two-thirds of current energy production in the U.S. Now, that's going to require tremendous investment in alternative energy resources. Now, what's being proposed right now is something like $1.2 billion in subsidies for alternative fuels and research and so on. What's actually needed is on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars. In other words, the equivalent of the entire defense budget being transferred from military to the transition to renewable fuels. Good idea, but so far we don't see the political will for that on either side of the aisle. There is no easy, quick answer to this problem. There's no magic elixir. Hydrogen certainly isn't it, because hydrogen is not even an energy source. We have to get hydrogen from other primary energy sources. Currently, virtually all commercial hydrogen is produced from fossil fuels, including natural gas and even gasoline and coal. So what's actually needed is a transformation of the entire modern industrial, we could say, American way of life, aiming for maximum energy efficiency, localizing and decentralizing our economies. The whole project of globalization that we've seen over the past decade or so has been all about maximizing distances between producers and consumers using cheap fossil fuels for transportation. That project of globalization has to be reversed. We have to run that movie backwards. We have to use alternatives now, even though fossil fuels may momentarily be cheaper. Why would fossil fuels be cheaper than renewable alternative fuels? Because fossil fuels are Mother Nature has done the work for us over millions of years. It's just a matter of sticking a straw in the ground and drawing the stuff off, and it's energy dense. It's the most powerful energy supply that human beings have ever had. Whereas solar, wind, that's more like running on the basis of yearly income. We have to redesign our economies and our lives for that. So we have to learn to use much less. And that's a message that Americans don't like to hear. We have the world's largest propaganda system called the advertising industry telling us in every possible way to use more, and only that will make us happy, only that will make us fulfilled. That message has to be reversed and we have to become aware of these issues and talk about them with each other. Now, that's a hard sell. So much easier to provide scapegoats, to say that there are enemies who wish to undermine our way of life, and if only we will mobilize and eliminate those enemies, those sources of evil in the world, we can maintain our way of life to which we are uniquely, God has given it to us, after all. The question about 9/11, therefore, is multidimensional and profound in its implications for our entire worldview, our entire way of life. We must get to the bottom of what happened on that day, and in doing so, we arrive at awareness of things that are themselves profoundly shocking and disturbing and will require even further levels of activism and hard work in order to change those things and preserve nature and humanity during the transition that is going to occur in the remainder of our lifetimes. We have a choice essentially between Plan A, which is to fight for the last drops, or to transform everything about industrial society, which will require, in addition to our sources of energy, also our financial and monetary systems, our agricultural systems, which are currently reliant on fossil fuels, and even, and this is possibly the most controversial of all, to find ways of, over time, as humanely as possible, reducing the human population. Because currently we are supporting 6.4 billion people and counting as a result of cheap fossil fuels used not only for agriculture but also for transporting resources from where they're abundant to where they're scarce. Currently, China is growing rapidly economically. We all have the image in our minds of China with the millions of bicycles on city streets. Well, just within the last year, Shanghai has banned bicycles from its major streets in favor of automobiles. The Chinese are buying automobiles at record rates. We are seeing the likelihood of an ultimate confrontation between the first and second foremost oil importing countries in the world, which are now the U.S. and China, over the remaining oil reserves. The alternative to that is going to have to be not only national, but international means of resource conservation and cooperation. The go-it-alone strategy of the Bush administration is exactly the opposite of that. I believe that if there were leadership from the U.S., there is the possibility for a global power down, global mechanisms for resource conservation and transition, of which the Kyoto Protocol could be a kind of model, although much more than that is actually needed. Kyoto is only the beginning. But, of course, we've seen the difficulty even of ratifying Kyoto without the U.S. being not only on board but in a leadership position. With the U.S. in leadership, this transition can be made peaceably and with minimal loss of human life and other species. Without the U.S. in a position of leadership, and in fact with the U.S. dragging its feet and going in the other direction, unfortunately, I think the overwhelming likelihood is for, as we've already heard the famous quote, war and war without end during the remainder of our lifetimes. this time, next few months, leading up to the next election, therefore, is an extremely crucial period of time. And the unraveling scandals from the books by Richard Clark and others are putting tremendous pressure on the current administration. These are people who are not going to give up power easily or lightly. If they have already done what they did on September 11th, what would they do in order to retain power if threatened? It's, I believe, a very dangerous time, but it's a window of opportunity that we must seize. If we do so, our children and our grandchildren will thank and praise us. And if we do not, I shudder to think what we and future generations will have to endure. Thank you very much.
That was Richard Heimberg. He spoke at the International Inquiry into 911 in San Francisco in March of 2004. Richard Heimberg is the author of The Party is Over, War, Oil, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. In part two of this one-hour program, you will hear from Mike Rupert, publisher of From the Wilderness. He also takes on the issue of peak oil. You can find more information on Richard Heimberg on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get information how to order a copy of this program on peak oil with Richard Heimberg and Mike Rupert by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.